what gets me excited to come into work every day is less about the short term and more about knowing myself. Like, I know what I enjoy. I know what parts of the job I enjoy. And the more I get to focus on those parts, the more I'm going to enjoy coming to work every day.
Hello, and welcome to the Jumpstart Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Sauer. Today, for our 84th episode, we're going to talk with Will Reynolds, Director of Strategy and founder at Seer Interactive. Now, Will is well known in the SEO community as an innovator, keynote speaker, and a general reality check for the industry at whole. And I've enjoyed following his blog posts and seeing him grow as a leader in the industry over the last several years. Now, MN Search, which is an organization I'm very fond of, has also been very fortunate to have Will join us as a keynote speaker at our annual MN Search Summit 2 times over the years, and he's constantly among one of the highest rated speakers every time that he goes out there. So I was very excited when Will struck up a conversation with me on Twitter a few months back, and it all came after he posted this article on Medium, and I shared out the article. Now, the post was titled Enough, or that's what I call it, and it basically, I think it post was titled When Life-Changing Money Isn't. And it's a must-read for anybody who's an entrepreneur or who dreams of one day taking the plunge into entrepreneurship. It highlights Will's decision-making process as he considered an acquisition offer for his company that involved a life-changing sum of money. Now, I shared that article on Twitter, and I shared it out to my agency course mailing list, and Will actually reached out to me on Twitter after I shared that article, and he said he loved my Twitter bio. Of course, my Twitter bio says, "Everything I own is in a 5x5 storage unit or on my person. I travel full-time and teach people to become better marketers." That's been my bio for a while now, ever since I did that journey where I started traveling full-time. And so that's what Will saw. And it seemed like the perfect time for me to ask Will if he wanted to join me on the podcast and answer my millions of questions about his business and the thoughts behind his decision. The resulting conversation is one of my all-time favorites from the podcast. See, Will and I have both thought very deeply about where we can get satisfaction in our work lives. We've both had successes in our career. Arguably, his is much more successful. But we've also wondered, where else can we have the most impact? And we share some of these ideas in this episode. Now, unlike most episodes, we didn't spend a lot of time on Will's backstory, and we got right into talking about the business side of things. So hopefully you like that, and let me know what you think about just jumping into things. Now, from a setting perspective, I was back in Minnesota during the recording. It was late December, negative 15 degrees outside, which is far too cold. And Will was working from home and was on parent duty, which meant that he was even holding his son while recording the second half of the podcast. Now, that's real entrepreneurship right there. You're going to love my conversation with Will Reynolds. For show notes, visit jefflytics.com/seer. Okay, we're here today with Will Reynolds. Will, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to talk to you. And the first time I ever was introduced to you, or the first time I started to get to know who you were, was you gave an epic talk, still referenced today, at MozCon. I'm not sure what year it was. You probably know better than me. The subject was Real Company Shit, or RCS, for those who like to censor themselves. And it's basically like, we need to stop chasing tactics and we need to start thinking about being a real company. So that was a really cool talk. What inspired you to give that? And what was the context behind doing it at that point in time?
Well, I had had a conversation with Mike King, and you know, he was like, just kind of off the cuff, saying like, you know, it's funny, as search agencies, a lot of people talk about all these different things, and people in the search business in general, not just agencies. And he's like, but when you work with huge brands, like at the time Mike was working with, he's like, the way that they look at the world is totally different. And he was just breaking down, like, he's like, I can't go in and talk about half the things that SEO talk about when they get together in a boardroom. And it was just like a little bit of a wake-up call for me to be like, damn, like, how often am I talking to clients about things that aren't about their bottom line, right? Like, we talk about rankings, or we talk about links built, or we talk about, you know, how link juice flows through a website. And it's like, none of that ends up in a freaking stock report, right? It's about dollars and cents. So it really was kind of my wake-up call to be like, how could I help kind of push our industry forward and push my company forward in a way where we spend more time talking about the impact we have on the business than on these kind of leading indicators, as if that those leading indicators are the destination in and of themselves.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it's exactly, I think, and I think the industry was needed that, because we did talk a little bit too much in jargon and sort of like drinking each other's Kool-Aid versus how do we get a spot at the table? How do we become the strategic advisor to big brands? And how do we get bigger budgets? How do we turn ourselves into a real company instead of, you know, a company that's chasing after the flavor of the day? And so I think it was a wake up call that we all needed at that time. Curious, how big was your company when you delivered that speech? Like what size, how many employees, any of those not numbers, but just like around the size.
Sure. So that year was 2012 is when I did that. So that means it was 5 years ago. I don't know how big Seer was 5 years ago. I'd imagine we were probably somewhere around, I'd say 70, maybe 70 ish, maybe. Mm-hmm. And in terms of size, I don't remember exactly how big we were in terms of revenue. I'd have to look that up.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I don't need to know the revenue number. It's more curious around just like the size of the business. And obviously, by the point you delivered that, you had already had several brands that you were working with. You must had the revenue to support these employees and everything. So obviously, it's sort of like a takeoff point. It seems like, even though you are, 70 is nothing to laugh at already. And so, yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. Cool. I don't know if it was a catalyst or not for any growth per se. Because when I look back at the numbers, it wasn't like we got some kind of crazy bump in clients around that time. What we did do is we had a few people who reached out and were like, oh my God, like, you sound like the type of agency I've been looking for. Because I think, when you report on BS KPIs, you know, that lead to the ultimate KPI you hope, you make more work for your point of contact. Like, they now have to take links and domain authorities and internal link flow, and you're making them translate that to a manager that cares about revenue. So the more you make your internal team members have to do that translation, the harder you make their jobs, which means they're more likely just to give the money to PPC.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they can't prove, it's nothing tangible if you're just throwing stuff out there and if you can't prove it at
all.
Yeah,
like right now I'm a big believer in using paid data to influence my SEO strategy. And I mean, a lot of people say that, but like, for instance, like, I have a client right now who has spent a little bit under $500,000 to get, tens of thousands of conversions for this one keyword in paid. And I'm showing them okay, so you're obviously comfortable spending $500,000 a year to get this number of conversions because you keep bidding on these words. Got it. Yet you're telling me you don't want to mention these words at all in your website, which is like, how, so you're just comfortable in perpetuity for the next 5 years, you're going to spend $2.5 million to get this one keyword, but you will not spend $10,000, $20,000, or $30,000 to drop on content to let that keyword potentially rank for you, or a set of keywords rank for you for the next, X number of years. It's just crazy.
Yeah, it seems like it's very short-term thinking. How do they respond when you bring up something like that?
We're going to find out in about 2 weeks. I'm going to go out and talk to them. Because you know what? It's funny. When you see things like that just don't make sense for the business, you know it's politics. C-level executives who are venture-backed, which this client is, they got numbers they got to hit. So somewhere the politics is keeping us from talking to this client about money. So my job is to go out there and just kind of help to reiterate, one, like, you're not getting the full value out of Seer or any search agency that you could be. And why would you not want to develop 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 pieces of content around this topic if in totality you're going to be spending millions over the next few years to be able to get those conversions? It's like, so I say things to them like, hey, is this company or is somebody that clicks on paid that much more qualified than the person who searches for the same exact keyword and scrolls down another 20 or 30 pixels? Like, you're going to tell me that they're that different of a type of person that you wouldn't even want to go after the organic or even try for a fraction of what you're going to have to spend forever on paid? So I'm trying to see if we can break down some of those just basic business rules on what makes sense for business.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that a lot of it comes down to, they might not even know that because they have different conflicting forces telling them different directions they need to go in. A lot of times I found is that companies will have tried doing SEO or tried something before and then didn't really understand what the results were going to be. And so they either just got it in their mind that it doesn't work, or they think that it's some kind of scam, or they worked at another company and they got taken for a ride or something like that. And so, and I think that SEOs often don't do a very good job of explaining what they're going to what the return is going to be. So it seems like if you can put it into that context, it becomes a pretty data driven and a no brainer argument if you can bring it up that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's what it's all about, is really surfacing the business context. And that's the RCS. I mean, everything you probably talk about now is going to come down to, like, this is how a real company acts, right? This is what companies need to look at.
Yeah. I mean,
this is what we do here.
Totally. I mean, you know, one of the biggest red flags for me, we just had a client who it looks like we're not going to continue working with, because, you know, their CEO used to do some SEO back in the day. And, you know, this CEO runs a sizable, good company that does great work, has great customers. But, you know, he types one keyword in and asks us questions about where he ranks for that word. And it's like, all right, well, if that's how you want to operate, then we're not the right company for you. Because this idea of maniacally focusing on one keyword and where you specifically rank for that one word just completely ignores things like location, mobile versus desktop, personalization. It's like, it's a new world, man. Like, and if you're going to sit on your computer all day and Google shit and then give my team, you know, a hard time about why we're number, you know, 11 versus one, it's like, well, did you do that incognito? No. Did you do that in different browsers? No. Well, you did it in Philly, right? Yeah. Okay. Well, your company is in Philly, so you probably rank higher here. And it's just one of those things where you're just like, damn, like that kind of thinking is just not the future of search. So I don't want to be aligned with companies that are so maniacally focused on domain authority and crap like that, that you can't even have a conversation about money. Like, we literally increased this client's revenue 20-30%, and he didn't want to talk about it. You know, he wanted to talk about where this one keyword ranked, and it's like, nope.
That's incredible, because it's like, that's the opposite of what a CEO should be doing in their role. Really, they should be the one setting the vision and having people worry about the minutia and the details. And so it's weird that they would be doing that, but I can see why that might be an ex client, because of that. That's, you can't, if they're focused on that, then who's focused on the business, right? Who's focused on the actual results?
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't give a shit, 'cause I'm not an investor. If I was an investor and I found out that my CEO was ignoring a set of technical changes that the SEO team did that resulted in 20% increase in revenue, like month over month, which you'll get value from for the next 3 years, to ask somebody about where one individual keyword ranks, I'd be like, yeah, you're not focusing on the right thing. So where else are you focused on the wrong shit?
Yeah, that's crazy. And so transitioning into your role at your company, are you in the CEO role then in the company? I remember, I think you wrote a post a couple of years ago about doing more like R&D type stuff and spending some time, or at least some of your time, focused on what's the future of the business. How are you using your time right now?
So I don't really run the business anymore. I mean, I'm functionally the CEO, right? At the end of the day, I get to approve big decisions, big decisions are rarely made without my input, or at least without somebody saying, hey, well, before we make this decision, we wanted you to know we're making it, right? But that's the only involvement I really want in terms of running the business, because I find running the business day to day to not be my strong suit. I find it to not be the best use of my talents. So yeah, I probably would say I'd say I probably spend 50-65%. No, I'd probably say it's more like 60-65%. Yeah, probably 60-70%. Let's put it there. So I'm actually calculating right now how much of my week I have blocked out, and I already know I have about a third of my week blocked out to work on big data. So that's that right there. And then when I think about the other meetings that I'm taking and whatnot, yeah, it's probably 65-70% of my time is spent in things related to R&D and where search is going, and breaking down silos and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I think that's a good use of, especially when you get to a certain point. So when you don't have that role, how did you backfill it? Did you just find somebody to become like an operations manager or president type role, or did you groom somebody within? How do you replace yourself in that function if you realize you're not maybe cut out for it?
So I was able to groom somebody from within, but I wasn't really in the position to groom them because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So they kind of groomed themselves, went out, got their MBA, started getting new mentors, that were more about finance and running a business and operationalizing the business than mentors in PPC or whatever. So I elevated Crystal to kind of run the business, because the other thing is, I think the more quirky you are as a CEO or a founder about how you make certain decisions, that, and it doesn't just most of the time come down to bottom line, the harder it is to get somebody from the outside. Because most people from the outside, when they're strong operators, they've been taught to look at a business through a certain set of metrics. And that's what makes them great at their job. The problem is when you come over top of them and you're like, whoa, 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 I know that you could have saved X percent on our healthcare, but like, you know, if three people this year get sick, those three people are going to be in a really bad place. And they're like, well, that's 2% of the company or 1% of the company. Like, it's not a good decision for us. And you're just like, man, we're going to have a lot of back and forth. So that's why I really like the idea of grooming somebody who had been with me for a while, because she knew how I went about making decisions. So therefore I knew or felt comfortable that I wouldn't have to be course correcting often on like, well, I get that that's how you used to do things, but here, this is how we do them. I never had to really do that.
Yeah, no, I think that's good too, especially, you know, given the position that you're in of owning the company outright and having, you know, all the stuff that you talk about in your Enough post, which we'll link to in our show notes and even talk about a little bit here. But if you're in that position, then I think, yeah, you could bring in an outsider, you could do that, but it sort of damages the vibe that you've already put out there. And when you're in the position that you're in to be able to call the shots, then there's no real, why would you bring in somebody that's telling you to change when you know where you're going, when you have a clear vision that you put out there? It's really, you know, you want people who are on board with that vision and who understand how to think in the way that you'd think or take care of things the way that you would take care of it, because it's working, right?
Yeah, well, and there's working for now. I mean, my issue is that I've always been a really short-term thinker, so I've been really good at solving short-term problems. Not great at understanding how my short-term solution could lead to long-term difficulty. So I think you also have to look for somebody who kind of understands spiritually where you're trying to take the company, because your day-to-day actions may not necessarily be right to hit where your heart is. So you need somebody who can see that longer, who can take your kind of strengths and interpret them into like what your long-term kind of vision is versus an executor / operator. So I really value the fact that Crystal looks at things differently than I do, because that's why she's in the role.
Yeah.
Whereas if she was just replicating what I did, Seer wouldn't be where we are. We would have probably never been able to grow or scale.
Yeah, it's like a 1+1=3 scenario, where if you add somebody into it, it makes you better. And then not only that, but it also allows you to focus on other areas. So curious about your thought on short-term thinking. So, and this is an excerpt from your Enough post, and it's basically saying you don't have a next thing, which I personally think that a lot of business owners in your position are in that scenario. Like we might think of an entrepreneur as like a serial entrepreneur, somebody who goes on and keeps on going. But I think a lot more sort of like they have this business that's doing well and they just enjoy it. And so I'm not sure if that's really short-term thinking or not, but you say like when you've been doing this for 15 years and you still wake up excited for the day ahead and you want to build a company instead of one that's focused on exiting and you're obsessed with the work. Is that what keeps you motivated? Is that since there is no, I mean, and you also talk about long-term plans in your posts and where you want to grow to and how you want to get there. But is that short-term thinking what keeps you excited every day to go into work then?
I never thought of it through that lens. I tend to think of my short-term thinking as a liability, right? I just can't see the scale of my decision sometimes. I think what gets me excited to come into work every day is less about the short term and more about knowing myself. Like I know what I enjoy. I know what parts of the job I enjoy. And the more I get to focus on those parts, the more I'm going to enjoy coming to work every day. For me, the parts that I enjoy most are things related to innovation and where our industry is going. And then helping to groom, really smart people and giving them a platform to learn and to grow and share with an industry their thoughts and beliefs. And as long as I'm kind of focused on doing those two things as, you know, the primary parts of my job, then I love coming to work. If I have to, let's say that my exec team, was dragging me into a lot of decisions related to, you know, HR or insurance or legal or, hey, how do we model out this issue then I would have less fun, and then I probably would be less likely to want to continue to do it. Or I'd have to find an exec team that was more comfortable making decisions without dragging me into every one of them.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's not, so it sounds like you're a problem solver, and you like to solve the problems, and some of these more, some of the business problems, frankly, those have already been solved. Like, there's people who go to school for that. They get MBAs. They, you know, these are, a lot of those things are not common, like the shopping for insurance or handling, you know, projections of revenue and bonuses and stuff like that. Those are roles that are clearly defined, and they've been happening for hundreds of years, versus the, what's the future of search or what is big data? It seems like that's the type of stuff where you want to solve bigger problems, both inside your company and outside as well.
Yeah. And I think I like focusing on where things are going, because I want to be a disruptor, not the disrupted. And, you know, because when you're disrupted, that leads to a whole set of things that are really not fun. You know, you have competitive challenges, you have pricing challenges, you have margin issues, you know, you're playing. Oh, there goes my son.
If you need to take care of
him. I think as long as I'm holding him, sure, he's going to be just fine.
Okay.
It's perfect. So funny, man. Like, shit is real. You know, it's like trying to balance out, you know, being a supportive husband, so that my wife doesn't feel like she's got to just give up her stuff she wants to do in her career, along with trying to run this company. Hey, buddy, how are you? Yeah, I'm just going to hold you, and then you're going to be really good so I can finish up this podcast, aren't you? That's exactly what you're going to do. But like, that's like, shit is real, right? Like, the amount of things that I'm trying to juggle to be the best dad I can be, to not be some absentee dad, to try to be a good husband, try to be there for my team and my employees and shit. Like, you know, it can be a lot, but it's the challenge that I'm up for, right? Like, I don't want to wake up and do the easy shit.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sign of a true leader, is somebody who not only sees it happening, but thrives on it, right? That wants to do that, and that wants to make people better. And obviously you have a lot of people that are counting on you, but it seems like you're doing it well. And you've found a way to remove yourself from day-to-day operations and that type of stuff that it can be really time consuming, and you're focusing on the business, right? I mean, you're in the business in many ways with like the actual delivery of work, and you said you work on some clients and everything, or at least contribute to them, but you also have some of that peace of mind because you have others taking care of the fundamentals of the business.
Yeah, I mean, they focus on the fundamentals, so I can make sure we don't get disrupted, right? And the funny thing is like, we need each other. That's the great part, is like, this business got bigger than me. Like, I can't run this business without them. Like, I can't even think for a second, like, oh, these people are easily replaceable. They're not. And that's not just my exec team. I mean, I think even all the way down to our newest hires, you know, it's like, they need me to make sure that we don't get disrupted, that I'm staying out there focusing on the future. And I need them to kind of deliver for clients in a way that I would have if I could have cloned myself. Like, I need them to care. I need them to go that extra mile. I need them to stand up for each other, you know, and support each other. So, like, it's kind of like, it's one of the things I love about getting big is you can't be Superman anymore. Like, you literally can't just solve every problem that comes to the company anymore. So you learn that relying on people, when you're smaller, relying on other people is like a nice to have, but in the back of your mind, you're like, I can swoop into any call, any issue, any time with anything and usually solve it. When you get to the size that we are, you start realizing like, I can't do all that without this team. So it becomes more of a, we need each other and we do more together than any one of us could do on our own. And I think that that's both good for the entrepreneur to have that sense of vulnerability, to go like, I can't run this company anymore. I can't be on every client call anymore. I can't jump into every fire anymore. And that allows other people to grow and also feel like they're empowered. And something that that people have said to me that I never thought was all that grand, but they're like, Will, your ability to truly trust somebody to run with something and not micromanage them and to actually want to delegate those things out, they're like, is very rare. They're like, a lot of entrepreneurs have a hard time letting go of that. And that leads to a whole slew of downstream issues that Sears just never run into, because I'm like, hey, I tell everybody, whoever wants to come and take anything that I'm working on, come get it, you know, come get it.
Yeah, no, I love that. So, and I was curious because I hear a lot of business advice, especially in the agency world, is that if you want to sell your agency to somebody and you want it to be worth anything, then you sort of have to remove yourself from the business to the point where it's not a single point of failure in the founder. Like, people don't want to buy a business where the founder has their hands in every pie, because then they, if they leave, then they can't be there. So a lot of times people talk about, they want the founder to be, they don't even give them an earnout necessarily. They take the asset of the company and their shares, and then they say, okay, you're done. We don't need you anymore. We want the production team and everything like that. Whereas in your post, it's like it sounds like you're the best of both worlds. Maybe you have the team running so well that they don't necessarily need you for day to day, and you have the reputation of the business. But on top of that, they're like, well, we want to keep you around to help us future proof, or to help us looking at what's in the future. Would you say that's accurate, or do you have any conversations during that process about whether you'd stay on or not, or is it ever questioned?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So every time that we've ever had somebody kind of come around kicking the tires, anytime I've ever taken any of those calls, usually people want to put me in a company like mine, because a lot of these companies, you know, the big ones, they tend to call you and they've got a formula, right? If you're not like $100 million, you know, they got a formula. So they're like, okay, you're going to be on we typically have you on a 4-year earnout. And luckily I have two advisors who have had their agencies acquired by some of these larger holding companies tiles. So that they were able to be like, this is what it's like. And they typically make you earn out over time.
Yep.
And they want you 4 to 5 years, regardless of your stature in the industry. Which means for me, they might have wanted to lock me up even longer, which did make turning down this one offer a little tough, because they were going to offer me enough upfront and a 2-year earn out that I was like, basically, if I didn't want to continue, I could have, the day after the wire hit the account, freaking quit, because the earnout wasn't that much and it wasn't that long. I think for them, they had that trust, because like, obviously talking to me, they're like, no, you really enjoy your work still. So how can we keep you working on the things that you'd want to work on? Because we don't see you wanting to kick up and retire anytime soon.
Yeah, no, I think that's cool. And that's a testament, obviously, because your timeline seems like it's a long timeline as far as where you want to go. I mean, basically you're talking about doubling your revenues in the next several years. You're talking about adding the team. You're talking about bringing some of your key players into an equity play. There's a lot of things, a lot of the decisions you're making are long-term decisions. And actually, I was curious about that too, because a lot of times entrepreneurs, myself included, they think that the validation that they're a worthy entrepreneur is an exit. So a lot of mental weight, a lot of mental validation and bandwidth goes into, well, if I don't sell for 7 figures, then I am a failure as an entrepreneur.
Yep.
If I don't do this, then I'm a failure. Do you have any thoughts on that? I know you covered it extensively in your post, but just curious as to your thoughts on that.
Dude, you know what's funny is I've never put that pressure on myself, because I already feel good about what I built. I'm not going to let somebody out there in the world affect how I feel about me to that level. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm sitting here holding my son, doing an interview, growing a company and all that stuff. And it's like, that's the stuff that to me that matters. Like, we're growing, we're doing well. I'm able to spend time with my kids the way I want to. So to me, those are the things that make me feel like I'm doing the right thing. I really don't need somebody to come along and give me X number of dollars to somehow make me feel better about me.
Yeah. That's great. So you don't need the validation. I mean, yeah, the validation's already there. I mean, and I'm sure if you go into your office and you look around, it's like, you've done some cool stuff. You know, you've been around the world. I know you're speaking everywhere.
I've already been validated, you know, and I don't mean this to sound cocky at all, but it's like, people fly me all over the world to hear what I have to say. You know what? That makes my mom and dad proud. Like, I can come and go as I want. I can afford some nice things in this world. So it's like, what more do I really need to feel good about myself? I don't really need these external validations. What I need is, I need to watch my kids grow up. I need to feel like I was a part of their lives as they were growing up. I need to feel like I'm supporting my wife in her career, since she's done so much to support me and mine. So it's like, those are the kinds of things that I look at, and I have to ask myself on a daily basis, am I doing those things at a level that I'm proud of? And that answer is yeah. And like I said in my post, like, having not come from any money myself is, you know, to me is a superpower. Like, I don't need to have this like, oh, I need millions to be to prove myself, because it's like, I'm already good. Look at where I came from. I'm already good.
Yeah. Yeah. You're already playing with the house's money, huh?
I'm playing with the house's money. I'm like one of the luckiest kids to come out of my freaking town. Like, are you serious? Like,
that's cool.
What more do I want? Well,
yeah, I mean, that's funny, because like, I mean, yeah, you talk about how when the revenues for Sear were around $1 million, you bought the house and you still live in the same house, still drive the same car, still have a lot of the same sensibilities. So it seems like that might have been for you, maybe your validation point was even then, like, just like, hey, I have a business, and hey, I got out and I did these things that weren't in the cards, I guess you could say, or were unexpected of me.
Yeah.
Which perhaps.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, that's
and
great.
The validation part, I mean, that's a scary freaking thing to me, man. Like, going through the world looking for somebody else to validate that your work was worth it or it's valued. To me, that is just a very scary place, because it means that the way that you value yourself is highly dependent, because we get so wrapped up in our companies as entrepreneurs, which we all do. I'm no different. Yeah. It's like, so if the way that you get your value is off of somebody else giving you a hunk of money for the thing that you built, it means that so much of your day-to-day self-worth is tied up in somebody else telling you whether or not you're worth it. And that's a scary place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that it's not always a great financial decision to exit either. I mean, like, that's the thing people don't realize, is that if you say that you did, you know, you say your timeline's 8 to 10 years of building up the company, well, the you'd make more than the amount of money you'd cash out easily if you stayed around that long. You also would pay probably less in taxes, because it's not all coming in one lump sum, perhaps. I don't really know how that exactly works, but you'd probably figure that out. But and also you have the validation, because again, you said there is no, like, you're not sure what the next step is or whatever. It's really just going forward and building this thing up. And so it seems like having that exit event would probably take all of the things that you've achieved and make it so that you'd, you know, it would, what do you do? What's, you know, you have your whole life, you have kids, you have, you know, they're going to be going to school, you say in the post, like, what do you do then? You sit around and what's next?
Yeah, I literally, if somebody came along and bought Sear, and I was talking to you today, and today was day one after the acquisition, and let's say I left after the acquisition, if this was day one, I'd be bored out of my damn mind. Like, yeah, I can take classes that I've always wanted to take. I can learn some things I wanted to learn. I can go take swim lessons. I can be a freaking, you know, a T-ball coach. But it's like, I like being heads down on my computer, figuring out ways to look at an industry through a different lens. And I could be an advisor. I could sit on some boards. But to me, it's like, I don't know, man. I like keeping my hands dirty. I like having some dirt under my fingernails. And I just don't know how to sit way back off of something and just kind of coast and just kind of advise once in a while. Like, I really want to be hands-on. So I might as well do that with my own company instead of jumping into somebody else's. And that comes with risk. I mean, Sear, we intentionally don't allow any clients to be too much of our revenue. So I don't think now we have any one client who is more than 9% of our revenue. So as a result, I don't have that concentration risk where I'm like, oh my God, literally tomorrow I could wake up and one of my clients could leave and I could have 40% revenue hit. So because I don't have that, there's a certain strength in that. You know, I don't mean that to sound cocky at all. I mean, I could have the perfect storm of losing my top 10 clients in the same 3 months, and then that would be bad. But the idea of having one client so wrapped up in our revenue has also been a really powerful position for us to be in.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what we all aspire to get. That's where we all aspire to get to, right? Is that you want to make it so that you can, like, there's different phases of business, right? When you're just getting started, it's any revenue is good. Anything is okay, because then you can pay your employees or whoever you have, and then pay yourself hopefully by the end of the day. And then you move on to the next step and you know, maybe reinvest in the business and you do these things. But there's always that feeling as an entrepreneur that it could all go away. And I'm sure that you still have some of that, right? Like, there is that feeling, even though over time, once you get to the point where now you're saying like no more than 9% of revenue, you're right. It's going away is a whole different story. You know, having profits that you could have banked and having money in the bank, the going away sounds less painful in that process, and you mentally are more prepared to deal with it. So then you can focus on these other things that are the high growth areas. And I think that almost anybody who starts off as a freelancer or starts off whatever it is, whatever you want to call themselves, consultant, agency, whatever it is, their dream is to be able to do R&D all day, basically, or to get to the point where they're just staying on top of the industry and getting there. But you have to eat a lot of shit in order to get to that point. You have to do a lot, and you have to make some really good decisions about who you hire. Otherwise, you'll never get there. Because if you're always, you know, babysitting other people, then it's never going to get you there.
No, you know, and I just wanted to bring that up because I'm not foolish in turning down this offer to believe that I'm not also taking some serious risk, that our company would get a much different valuation if I had this perfect storm and I lost a bunch of clients at the top end, and let's say Sears worth a lot less. If your growth stagnates, you know, you have a couple years where you grow at, you know, 5-10%, you get a very different valuation than if you've got 3 or 4 years in a row where you're growing at 20-25-30%.
You know,
so I'm fully aware that I may not ever get the valuation that I got this last time, and I got to be okay with that, right? Because to me, winning is not whoever gets the most money at the end. So I'm completely comfortable getting a valuation someday, let's say 25-30% less than what I got today, and I would still feel like I did a good job. Whereas for a lot of people to even say that, they'd be like, well, that would hurt that validation, right? It's like, well, I guess I didn't do as well as I thought I had done, or maybe the world doesn't look at me the same way because I had to take a smaller offer. But for me, it's I don't have my it's just, I'm just not all wrapped up in that number being my, like, now I know I did a good job. You know, I've always looked at, have I done a good job, starting with, like, am I there for my family and are my parents proud? Mm-hmm. And those two boxes are checked. So therefore everything else is kind of sugar on top.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's going back to the house's money aspect. And you touch on this as well in your post about, like, what's the difference between having 500,000 and a million, between a million and five, and you give these different steps that you increment. And it sounds like, I mean, really it's more, you know, and I, this is an exercise, and this, where you and I got into contact is I liked your post, and then you looked at my bio, and I've actually, like, I pretty much cashed out of life in general, put everything in a storage unit, and I've been traveling for the last 3 years with my wife, and we sort of had that same thing. She was on the partner track at a CPA firm. I'm a partner in my agency still, and we were both like, okay, we could just keep on working here and making good money, you know, being beyond the money we could make, but how is our life going to change? Like, what's the difference between making, you know, when you're in the six figures, like, what are you going to do differently? Take nicer vacations, drink a nicer bottle of wine. You had mentioned things like flying privately those are nice, but that's just like a small aspect of your life at that point. And so it's like, what do we need this for? You know, what's the point?
And I think that's where so few people can get to. And I'm not making any judgments here, right? I will tell you that the difference between $500,000 and $1 million was massive, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm not here to make judgments. But my point in bringing that up was everybody's got to go through that progression to eventually find, where does it stop adding value? And if you don't go through that progression, 100 to 250, 250 to 500, 500 to a million, a million to 5 million, 5 million to 10, 10 to 20, 30, 40. You have to start to say, at what point can I not even imagine or invent shit that I could look at and be proud of, you know? Like, could I spend money to take, you know, Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic into freaking space for 30 seconds? Yeah, but, like, is that the kind of person I want to be? No. Okay, well, then you start being able to make some cutoffs. And then that's also super empowering, because then you literally, like you said, you're waking up with the house's money. Like, I wake up every morning and I'm like, I'm doing this because I love it still. And I don't know about for clients and whatnot, but think about it. Like, you know, somebody can go to work every day because they feel they got to hit some number to pay back their investors and to get people off their ass this quarter. Or you could have somebody who's building a company and growing it as your agency, who is literally like, I'm waking up because I love this shit still. Like, I could have cashed out. And done what 90% of people would be like, hey, dude, if you can cash out and not have to work again or choose every day, I'm like, I'm already choosing every day. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So yeah, it just doesn't feel like any pressure or stress there.
Yeah, no, it's nice because then you once there's less pressure and stress, it's like almost like you can focus on the impact you make, like the big impact. And so you can make that conscious decision as to whether work, you know, growing the business and having clients and being a thought leader in the industry, if that's the impact. I know you do a lot of charitable work and give to charity, not even just give to charities. You actually become part of them, you know, which is really cool. And it's almost like in modern society, like once farming could be done, you know, in the 1900s, I think it was like 85% of people lived on farms. And now it's like 1% of the population produces food for everybody else. Well, guess what it does when 1% produces the food and not everybody else needs to worry about producing their food? We can do more. You can make progress. You can make innovation. And so I'd assume that it has to be the same for the business. If the business can produce the revenue, now you get to focus on things in society, things in your own life that wouldn't be capable if you were just doing sustenance the whole time.
Yeah. And I think the other great part is hopefully I can allow a bunch of other people at Seer who've come along on this ride to be able to say the same. And right now I can say that for myself. One of my goals is how can I say that for 5 people at Seer by the end of, you know, next year? And is it 10, mm-hmm. you know, 2-3 years after that? And then is it 20 after that? You know, it's like, how can I bring more people along with me now that I've kind of hit my ceiling personally in terms of what I need? But I still love growth. It's like, well, what's the purpose then if it's not for me? And it's like the purpose is to see how many other folks that have really made some sacrifices and worked their asses off for Seer could be brought along on that path.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think that's a good way to look at it. And it also sort of, it protects your investment, like your investment of your time and everything. And actually not selling is an investment in one way, right? You're doubling down on your investment of everything in there because you didn't take the exit. You're basically letting it ride. You're putting it out there and you're letting it work for itself. So that might be the best investment you ever make is not taking the buyout. And likely it will be. If you can get to those goals you're talking about, it'll be worth significantly more. And so that's another thing that, you know, from a business owner perspective, I think we sometimes forget about is that if somebody else wants to buy your company, their plans aren't just to recreate or just to keep things the same. Their plans are to make money off of it. And mm-hmm. so if somebody else is willing to do that and to give a premium for it, their plans for you are pretty grand. And that means that if you can do it for yourself, you're going to be taking 100% of that upside versus somebody else.
But I think that's the fallacy of entrepreneurship though, right? Is like entrepreneurs keep thinking they're going to continue to grow.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. Because most people fail on that path to whatever growth goal they set. So I don't want to ever be disillusioned to believe that. And that's why I was saying this earlier is like, if my company flattens out and we stop growing, or we start having some down years, I still am good. I still feel good about what I've done because I have to be cognizant when I'm turning down the offer that is a very real possibility. And there's so much survivorship bias out there that the only stories you actually remember are the ones where people, you know, where Facebook turned down, you know, an acquisition from Yahoo. Well, yeah, everybody wants to talk about that still. Nobody wants to talk about fucking Groupon, who fucking turned down $2 billion from Google, and now they're worth like, you know, $300 million. Like, nobody wants to talk about those people that have turned down those offers and then are worse off for it. The difference is that in my situation, I'm already okay, so therefore I don't feel the need to have to – that if for some reason Seer got a huge chunk out of our valuation, that would somehow still be a failure to me, whereas you better believe – for the investors behind companies like Groupon and all these other companies that have turned down buyout opportunities, you know, they're not too happy that they didn't take that two billion from Google when they could have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it just sort of proves that your philosophy is very much around like, I mean, you mentioned like debt is the mother of all stress. I couldn't agree with that more. So being outside of debt. And having the point where pretty much no matter what you do, you don't need to worry. You're probably not going to have to worry about debt, save for any kind of disaster scenario or something like that. It allows you to do more and to look past that. Because I think these other companies, you know, they sort of like they're either getting in debt to get to that point, or there's all these other factors that go into it that they need that money. If you don't, then you get to make better. You get to make more clear decisions.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said earlier too, to go back a couple points I wanted to just bring up was when you also look at how you can grow your team's wealth, it's a different day-to-day of why you wake up and the mentality. Whereas what I find is no matter how many people are giving out shares to their employees and, oh, I have ownership, it's like most companies that have investors are set up to make sure the investors do well.
So really, the employees are always the ones that get shit on at the end. So you might have hundreds of shares, but you don't understand liquidity preference. So if you don't understand liquidity preference, most people have no idea what that means when they get shares. So they don't even know to ask for it. You go and find out that the investors have got to get 2x their money or you know, before anybody else gets paid, and that they've got preferred shares and you got common. If you can't explain all that shit, then what you don't realize is that even though you have shares and you think you got a part of something, the deck is stacked against you. You know, I think one of the best stories I've ever read about this topic was the people that built Zipcar, I believe, sold to Avis for like hundreds of millions of dollars. And the CEO and the co-CEOs, I think one of them got like $1.5 million. And, you know, you read about this big exit, and what really happens is that she got completely screwed, which means that you can imagine the employees, if the CEO got so little, most of the employees probably didn't get squat. But I bet you that there was this belief that, oh, my God, you know, the reason why we want to go public or the reason why we want to get acquired is because of all these great things are going to happen. Look how many shares I have. But they have no idea of the downstream, of the way the system is kind of almost like, I hate to say it, but it's almost rigged against them. When you look at things like taxation and whatnot, it's like, so you're going to give somebody options. They're going to get taxed on that now on current value. Like the other folks don't have that, you know, the investors don't. So you start understanding that like this idea of a company giving you shares is a big farce. And I think people have got to be careful. What are you going to spend? Like, you know, all the many hours trying to learn what liquidity preferences are and how they work and start asking all those questions. No, you're not. So you're going to end up getting screwed. So it's another reason that I think people really need to understand that when their founder stands in front of them and says, hey, here's what I'm trying to accomplish. And here's what I'm comfortable kind of, you know, helping people to have a piece of the company. And I own 100% of the company. That is a way different conversation. Here are your 1,000 shares versus somebody else who goes, oh, I own 25% of the company as your CEO. The board owns and the investors own, 65% or whatever that number is. And that last 10% is for you guys. So here's your 1,000 shares. Totally different ballgame.
Oh, absolutely. And it seems like that's a different ballgame. And it's not a ballgame that a lot of people want to play. And you're right. There's not necessarily resources that allow you to project that out. Versus a wholly owned company, you can start to at least have an idea as to what that's worth. Because I think valuations for agencies are very difficult to go through as well.
Very difficult.
Well, we're near the end of our time, so I have one quote sort of summarizes what you're just talking about from your post, and it's basically too many inspiring entrepreneurs that you're looking up to are fucking broke. I can't tell you how many exits I've seen where somebody just got their debt covered. But they don't say that. They talk about they got acquired for millions, and then you don't know that they never paid themselves for 10 years, and they have all this debt. And so they're basically breaking even on the whole proposition. I think that that's exactly what you're talking about here, is that there's a lot of different paths we can take. You know, you can work for a startup. You can have the startup give you stock options as a compensation vehicle. They can pay you below market in order to, you know, get talent below market, and then hopefully you get the upside. But we always, and it's always celebrated the upside, the Ubers, the Airbnbs, the Googles, the Facebooks, those are the ones that are celebrated. For every one of those, there's what, thousands of companies that none of that happens, that end up making nothing. And so it's crazy to think that versus a private company in this service, you know, in the industry, the valuations might not be as high, the amount of value, you know, like the multiple of how much revenue you make versus how much your company is worth. It probably isn't going to be nearly as sexy as a startup, but it's a lot more stable. It's generating cash. It's actually well run, you know, it's a well-run business that's generating revenues. And so there's a lot to be said for that as well.
Exactly. And it comes back to validation again, right? Like validation is a dangerous thing to be out there seeking when it comes to your business, because everybody wants to talk about their exit. And I look at these fucking people and I'm like, dude, you barely got your debt covered, like barely. And you're on the hook as part of your earnout to maybe cover that debt. So it's attached to you hitting certain goals that you don't even know if you're going to hit or not. But yet I watch these people get lauded in the public, like, oh man, they exited. Look how great they were. And they're eating all that shit up. Why? Because it gives them that dopamine blast in their brains to make them feel good about themselves. But the reality is when they go back home, they're still struggling to write the checks they got to write to pay for their mortgages and to cover their fucking cars and all that shit. And it's like, but nobody knows that. right? And they want to continue to perpetuate that story, which is why I'm a big proponent of talking more about the hard things than the, hey, look how great my company is. And yeah, look, I'm going to be great and go buy a Ferrari. Like, no, there's enough of that out there.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I get a lot of Facebook ads and it's like, guy starts $50 million agency in his sleep. Right. Sells it, and then why is he selling me a $1,000 product on Facebook? if you're that successful and you have that much money, then why? You know, ooh. So either you have this disease where you need more, the disease of more, or you're lying. One of those two, it's somewhere in between,
dude, right? Because if you were really that fucking successful, the way that you would really go to market is you're like, I'm paying for ads, and I'm going to do this for free because I want to see more people be successful. I don't need your money because I have enough of it. Whereas those ads, right, you're like, oh, there's $1,000. And it's like, yeah, sign up for my masterclass. It's like, no thanks.
Yep. Now, I, of course, do have an agency program, but I price it more of like the, you know, make a little bit of money off of it. Mostly I want to help more people. And I think that's definitely a summary of what you're talking about too, is like with this, with not exiting, you're going to be able to make a bigger impact for more people.
You're going to be able to do it on
a longer timeline.
I hope I can. You know, I just find it hilarious when average Joes like us are way different. We got to get paid for our time. When somebody talks about how they cashed an 8-figure check or a 7-figure check last month, and then they want to charge me $1,000, me and 10 other people $1,000 this month to sit in their masterclass. I'm like, wait a second. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you gotta consider the source, right? And anybody who's listening, just do back of the napkin math. Just think about it. Does this even make sense? Like, what volume does it need? How do these things work? Are these numbers there? I mean, I know that we're in the headline clickbait world now where everything has to be make a bunch of money online or giving very specific numbers about how much you made this, but consider the source, consider whether or not this actually makes sense or not. And don't be blinded by that stuff.
Well, consider the cost.
The reality is, keep your expenses low. Keep your expenses low, make more than you spend, and do it over a long enough timeline. That's the secret, right?
Seriously. Like, I can show anybody that I can make 7 figures in a month with some kind of plan, but the problem is, I got somebody's ready to wake up. The problem is what did I have to spend to make that, right? If I spent $2 million to flash you $1 million check, that's not winning. But if I only tell you and show you that I got $1 million check this month, then you have no idea that I spent $2 million and that I need you to sign up for my masterclass to cover my freaking $1 million loss.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a good ending point, Will. Thanks so much for sticking with me this time, especially having your son with you. And that's great that we could talk this long. So really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? He cooperated. So thanks for being willing to hear you and your audience dealing with some whining during the podcast. So I apologize for that.
Yeah. It's just RPS, real parenting shit, right?
It is real, man. Yep. You know, this is real entrepreneurship, right? It's that, like, sometimes you're just like, well, I've got to figure out a way to make all these things happen at the same time. You can't always do everything at 100% or you'll get nothing done, you know? Well, thanks for having me.
Yep, absolutely.
Really appreciate you doing it, and let's stay in touch.
Thanks for joining me, Will. Hope you are somewhere warm at this point and that you can soon close on that condo in Rio. It was really cool to hear Will's plans for personal and professional growth, and I look forward to watching his next moves closely. And there's one thing I can say for sure, and that is that Will can control his own future. As we established in the interview, it's like he's playing with the house's money. And I think that would make a great episode title. For show notes, visit jefflytics.com/seer.